in the equation, then you have to be very careful not to become a utopian in this attempt to be ecologically fitting. And the single house is becoming more and more utopian.
Could you explain what you mean by utopian? You're using the dictionary definition of it.
Well, I think that the one of the definitions is that to be a non-place.
Yes.
That's what I tend to use most of the time. Well, it seemed that when we build the single house with its own little parcel of ground, unconsciously we say that the earth is maybe 20 times as big as it is. Well, this is not true. The earth has its own size, and the demands that we're putting on the earth are becoming greater and greater. So to say that I like the single house, so I'm going to define an environment which satisfies me, it's not sufficient. I have to say, now suppose that everybody else wants what I want. Does this make sense? Then immediately I find out that this doesn't make sense. We cannot have the 5 or 6 millions of billions of people, the 3 or 4 billions of families dwelling in single dwellings. We need many herds for that. But that to me is not the most cogent reason why the single house might not be the answer. The reason is that the single house is not conducive to that kind of environment, with that kind of pressure and that kind of tensions and that kind of intensity that will foster the metaphysical. The making of God.
Following that line of thought, there's the implication that proliferation of one-family houses is the work of the devil.
I was going to say. Well, the devil is not something, a monster. The devil is it's a very quiet process.
You speak with some authority. You think we maybe need some devils?
We need to understand that there's a demonic element in life. And this demonic element is, I think, is there by necessity because we are dealing with an inner mystery and an outer mystery. The inner mystery is what is inside of us, and we don't know what it is exactly, if physiologically, psychologically, and so on. And the outer mystery is what surrounds this inner mystery. So we cannot escape the indeterminate, then unexplainable, and the necessity of jumping, of leaping into what as yet is not proven, or as yet is not guaranteed. And there's more to it. This double mystery goes for evidently for what I call a substantial element of anguish. And this is inescapable. We can fool ourselves into this idea of the pursuit of happiness and into this idea that if we can insure ourselves physically enough with abundance of hardware and holdings, we might get away from this anguish. We are not going to get away. We're going to get deeper and deeper in it. Because the resolution of this anguish, it's not in physical terms, but it's in sacramental terms, or whatever you want to call it. That's why religion is so important. But I think we should take religion not by the tail, but by, not in reverse, but in what I see is the in the right sequence. At the beginning is mass energy, at the end is God.
Is there any way one can, I guess I'm speaking as an architect, how do you relate concepts such as anguish with architectural manifestation?
Well, one little corner of my theory is that anguish can be conquered by an act of creation. In fact, the only way you can conquer anguish, if not forever, but for a moment, is by creating, by transforming this anguish into an act of creation. And for me, the aesthetic is the true act of creation.
You're associating anguish and entropy.
Well, in a sense that the reason for the existence of anguish is that entropy seems to be dragging everything in the opposite direction of sacredness, of consciousness.
This then is a way of understanding a term that you've used, aesthetogenesis.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a word of your invention?
Well, it's the genesis of the aesthetic.
You've ascribed more meaning to it than that, though. You've identified it as a holy act.
Yeah, I did that because I resent this popularization by which anybody in any kind of mood, in any kind of situation, creates something. Well, we don't.
You don't really believe in Sunday painters?
Oh, yes, I believe in Sunday painters. I believe that might be one of the recommended, commendable activities. But let's face it, this is something that reveals and gives vent in healthy way, maybe, to idiosyncrasies, which are very interesting to me, the person that paints, but very relevant to you, the person that, the beholder. And the genesis of the aesthetic needs two elements, the personal and the universal. And if I come up only with the personal, that's my bag. But I shouldn't importune or brag or scream about my bag. My bag is my bag. And that's why most of what we call art is it's a moral play or a psychological exercise or a therapeutic exercise, which are all very, very important, very necessary, but we are still not touching on a creative act.
There are very few people who are architects, and even fewer architects have the opportunity to exercise their art, to try to look at things from a more universal.
This is not peculiar to the architect, though. It's peculiar to life.
So, where does the ordinary person fit in this whole scheme?
Well, there are no ordinary persons, in one sense. We are all extraordinary, because ordinary tends to be fundamentally non-life. But our extraordinary characters are contained within certain limits, which are the limits of the person. So I think mediocrity is not inborn in anyone. Mediocrity is the choice that any one person can make when it acquiesces.
Yes.
To limits which are inferior to the limits that this person can define for itself. Take music. Most of us enjoy music. Might be good, bad, so-so, indifferent. But very few of us are composers. So to say that because we cannot be composers, we cannot enjoy music, doesn't make sense. There is the composer which originates a specific set of sounds. There's the performer which is able to give to those sounds a certain substance, and sometimes even add a little or subtract a little. And then there is the listener, which vicariously enjoys the creative act. And I think this is true for any other field of endeavors. Very few people are composers. A number of people are performers. Most of us are beholders, vicarious creators, and so on.
Well, it's easy to understand how singing in the shower can be pretty healthy for almost everybody and everything. But to be creative about one's environment seems to be fraught with all kinds of global dangers. Mm-hmm. And so from that point of view, comparing, let's say, music with architecture seems to be a bit dangerous. How does, quote, the extraordinary person involve himself creatively in his environment? Because, you know, it can be argued that really the self-destruction of Phoenix is simply at the hands of these, what I would call ordinary and what you'd call extraordinary people.
Well, first of all, the analogies are always, they have to be taken as analogies, so you're right in saying that you cannot pick up the musical field and then put it into the environmental field. But I still think that it's quite appropriate to try to illustrate what generally happens by taking music as an example. And I think it should be clear also that the more you have something to say, or you think you have something to say, the more you become responsible. So the more you live dangerously, and the more you put danger in what you make. But this is inherent to what life is. The least dangerous thing is to be an atom of hydrogen or something like that. Mm-hmm. Because you know that you'll be there forever. Forever and ever. Well, you'll be part of me, part of the carpet, part of that in different times, and you can be sure of your eternal existence. And the more you move into complexity, the more you live dangerously. You're dealing with not ephemerals, but highly unstable and highly special kind of conditions. So you move further and further into almost into the hypothetical. But that's really the stuff of life. You can't escape that.
Well, certainly in terms of complexity, being involved in the design of the environment is a much more demanding activity, let's say, than music.
Yes or no? A divine piece of music is as difficult to be composed as any divine building or as any divine city, I think. At a certain point, the measurement is only how much power radiate from this object, which might be notes on a piece of paper or a city.
still, I keep thinking, comparing the musician with the architect, that the musician's wares are certainly more innocent in their impact on this earth than some of the things that builders are doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in a sense, an earthquake can do more than the most beautiful piano piece. Mm-hmm. But the earthquake stands for entropy. Piano piece stands for God.
How can everyone become a responsible architect?
Well, by being a responsible man. And then finding out if its inclination is to be involved in environmental problems. Because you can be the most responsible man and decide that architecture is not what I should be responsible for.
But one can avoid music. One can't avoid the environment that he's living in.
Mm-hmm.
So to that extent, it is even more a universal responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it involves, in a way, survival and well-being.
Survival in the mm-hmm. most base terms. What do you see the role of the architect, then, if this is an understanding of the importance of environment? Presumably, architects should be in some sort of leadership role. But what should they be doing?
Yeah. Well, we say that democracy is to serve the people. So the architect should do what the people ask for. If that's democracy, I'm out, absolutely out. First of all, I don't think that any one of us knows exactly what we want. Second, I think that most of us tend to want things which we really would not want if we made a little greater effort to understand ourselves. So to say that there is a market and I have to satisfy the market, I think it's an irresponsible act. So as you were saying, the architect has to be a leader, like any person has to be a leader.
Well, particularly if he possesses expertise in his field, he has some larger responsibilities that are well outside of himself.
Yeah, it has to be a sense of responsibility for one thing, and then try to go on from there. And the sense of responsibility might go as far as making this person to decide that that's not the field he should be in, or she should be in.
Still, it seems as though we have some very large problems in relating what architects can do to the larger social responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we have problems.
Yes.
There's no ways about it.
Since I know the thing, and perhaps you know it also from the architect's point of view, I wonder if there's any way to think about it from the other point of view,
mm-hmm.
from the non-architect's point of view. Maybe there. That's a way to be. That's another way to get into the problem and try to understand what's
mm-hmm.
possible.
Well, yeah, if you set yourselves in a corner and say that there's the populace there, there's mankind there, and there's me here, and I'm going to be to dictate to this mass what's good for the masses, evidently we are off. So you have to try to be human and understand that you belong to the system and to the group and to humanity, and then try to understand what the needs of this humanity at the present might be, and then try to do your best to perfectly clear and we both need. And most of the time, seems to me the architect doesn't do that. The architect vents ideas about single problems, and then when it gets down to a certain contest, tends to forget those problems. That came up yesterday, I think, in the Alla Cosante, in the discussion. And I said something about to this girl that was asking me, keep in mind there's a bell ringing in the back of you, and the bell says energy, segregation, pollution, land conservation, complexity. And those rings should keep ringing, because if you forget one of them, then evidently you're forgetting something very substantial. And only when those bells ringing tells you that you are conscious of them and you are trying to work with them together, you might come up with at least a partial answer.
That's a tough one. Maybe we should take a break here.
Mm-hmm.
Or are you just warmed up?
I thought this was the end. What time is it?
Well, we haven't gotten into your personal life yet. Could we quiet down, please? In this conversation with Paolo Soleri, I'd like to try to review some of the events in your life, if you're ready for history. Maybe we could begin by looking at your monogram. And I wonder if you could explain what this symbol is supposed to mean.
I'm supposed to be remembering? What does it mean?
Well, it's on your letterhead.
That's going to disappear in the next edition. I think I had that represented the foundation work, and those were representing some kind of a collaboration or help coming from different institutions, but what those were, I don't remember. I remember this school was one.
So that in effect this was a stylized diagram of...
Or a certain cooperative effort that would have some kind of a center in a foundation and try to grow into something.
And this was something that you designed in the mid-60s when you started to focus on the Cosanti Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
You say you're going to discontinue using it.
Yeah, for a long time has been meaningless to me.
Have you designed a new monogram?
We have one for Cosanti, which is a little similar to the Cosanti symbol, but... Yeah, we might use that.
Can you explain why you're in Arizona? I mean, is it an accident? Is it an act of fate or of faith?
Faith.
F-A-I-T-H.
No, it's a combination of accidents and interests and so on. The main thing was that Frank Lloyd Wright had its winter quarters here, which means that I happened to come here and get acquainted with this environment because I came to stay in the foundation, Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation.
But still, you must find Arizona very sympathetic to your needs or you wouldn't be here.
Well, I tend to like the warmish, warmer climates. I like very much the landscape of the West.
You mean the openness, the
full
and the strength, horizon?
The strength and the frugality of the landscape.
I'm a little bit surprised that you're not more intrigued with oceans. Maybe it's the fact that you weren't born on an ocean.
No, I'm intrigued with the ocean, but we are waiting for California to sink in.
Just to fall off.
So we are building boats in our backyard.
But you have not... you did live in Italy in Vietri for 3 or 4 years on the sea.
Well, my greatest experience of the sea was not when we moved in Vietri, when I started bicycling throughout Italy, and I was 18 or so, and suddenly there was the sea. And I had seen the sea only when I was 4 or 5, and we couldn't afford it because we were too poor to get to the sea. So that was the great moment for me to get acquainted with the sea. Around 18, when I got there by bicycling from the inland,
and
to it.
Where did you see it first? Then at Genoa, or
it was in Genoa, but it was not far from Genoa. Yeah.
You mentioned seeing Italy by bicycle at the age of 18. How was that? Just a summer, or did you spend a longer time?
No, it was summer trips.
And you camped?
Yeah, I camped. I was picked up by a naval outfit, and I had sketches. So they decided I was a spy. This was at the beginning of
the war.
Yeah, 38 or so. No, I was 20, you know, then.
39. 39, yes. So you were 20 years old. Did they lock you up?
Yep. In one of the oldest fortresses, prison fortresses. And,
where was that?
Sarzana, not far from Viareggio.
Oh yes. But they let you out.
5 or 6 days. It ruined my Ferragosto. Yeah.
5 or 6 days.
It was an experience because you were in with very old people. You know.
Were you in?
People that robbed. Picked up 3 apples because they were hungry, or it was quite an experience.
So, you weren't in with political prisoners, you were in with
petty criminals.
How did they clear you?
Oh, they finally got some information from my family and so on. But I never got my sketches back. Oh, the CISS number.
Well, also during the war, you spent some time in France at Grenoble.
No, I spent that time before the war in Grenoble. Yeah.
Oh, that was before the war.
Mm-hmm. I was 14 or 15.
Did you go to school in France?
For 7 or 8 months, yeah.
But no longer than a year. You knew France from your Italian school background, or you just picked it up?
Oh, the language?
Yes.
Yeah, I learned when I was in school.
You once mentioned a little story about how you evaded the draft.
I never evaded the draft. I refused to become a lieutenant.
But you were in uniform.
Oh, yes.
And how do you avoid being promoted?
I had what you call in Italian a punta d'ernia, which means the beginning of an hernia. So in order to become a lieutenant, you would have to operate. You couldn't be a new lieutenant with an hernia. So I never enjoyed the idea of commanding people, and definitely not commanding people in on a battlefield. So I decided I would remain a private.
A private.
Mm-hmm. So that was it.
How did you accomplish that?
I didn't get my hernia off.
Oh. I've never quite understood how you could continue your architectural education during the war. The school, the Polytechnic kept open?
Oh, yeah. In the last 2 years, I couldn't do exams because I was a non-person, because I didn't register with the fascist republic. But I was very lucky. I was picked up once, but luckily I was picked up by the Italian army, not by the German army. So after being told that I was a traitor, etc., they kicked me out.
But fundamentally, you were going to school full time.
No. I don't remember ever going to school full time, but I was going enough to be able to follow the classes, but I couldn't go through with the exams until the end of the war.
So then at the end of the war, you could take the final examinations in the school?
Well, complete the exams that I didn't have before and then finish.
Do you think, well, I'm sure that the war had a lot of effect on you. How, can you relate how it might have directed your ideas?
Well, I'm sure everybody was affected. What surprised me is the dullness and the what do you call it? The lack of understanding of really what's happening. At least on my part at that time.
You mean you really didn't have a comprehensive idea what it was all about?
I mean, supposedly I had it in a sense that, you know, you would listen to the London clandestine news, and I happened to be in touch with few elements that were quite in. But the more I look back, the more I feel that there was a great amount of irresponsibility in my part. Due to just, you know, you live day by day and you hear about things and you go on your own.
In other words, you're surprised at how normal your life was during the war.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, as I was saying, I had great luck because I could have been deported many times. I could have ended up in anywhere in Russia or in a concentration camp, who knows what, and I wasn't.
So do you think that living through the war affected any of your ideas of social responsibility?
Well, a posteriori, when the thing starts to leak into you, begin to penetrate into you, then you begin to realize what happened. But it took years to realize what's happening.
You're still educating yourself that way.
Oh yeah, in fact there is almost a what do you call it? Anything that refers to those times, it's now very important to me. Any documentary, anything that relates to those years, it's very, very important.
You feel that you have to catch up with what happened to you?
In a sense, yes. And then you had to gear your behavior now to your behavior then somehow.
That's interesting, because if I could make an observation, I'm not sure that you're particularly historically minded. But that event you feel some special responsibility about.
Mm-hmm. Well, historically minded, you mean in general, or you mean your history?
I mean it both ways.
Well, what what belongs to your own history, I think it's very much present in everyone.
Yes, but some people live in the past, and some people tend to avoid the past.
Yeah, but that war is very present. It's very present, not just to me, to everyone,
yes.
Even if you don't know it.
Yes, I
it was a trauma of gigantic proportions.
Yes, we're still much, still very much in it. I think one of the interesting aspects of your history has been this combination of Italian and American experiences and the manner in which you maybe have synthesized two cultures that aren't totally identical. How do you look on yourself as an American? I realize you don't carry a passport, but you...
I might.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You're certainly at home here, and you have very much identified yourself with American issues. Did that come difficult, with some difficulty?
Well, I identify with American issues when I see them as universal issues, as world issues. I'm pretty much uninterested in American as such, as I'm not interested in Italy as such. I wish I could lose my citizenship, any kind of citizenship, because I don't believe in citizenship. But at the same time, I'm not making any effort to proselytize the universal citizenship or anything like that. I haven't done anything about it.
But in effect, your concept of citizenship is a very strong one. It simply has universal boundaries and not national.
Yeah. Well, then you know, you're a citizen of the world. What does that mean?
Yeah. But when you got married, you rather deliberately returned to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, you hoped to be able to live there.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, Carly was very eager to find out what Italy was.
Mm-hmm.
So we.
But also, you had come to this country to learn, not necessarily to settle.
Yeah. That's right.
So you returned to Torino,
mm-hmm.
And then you left it. You went
south.
You went south. Was it the coldness, or what were the factors that made you leave the place that you were brought up?
Well, the idea of going back was to try to begin a process which maybe was similar to the Frank Lloyd Wright situation, where you have your family within a larger group.
Yes.
Maybe it was the tribal thing, I don't know. So that was the intention, so we attempted to develop that. At a certain point, we started, we had the beginning of that. We had one or two persons that were willing to try this.
This was in Torino?
Yeah. So we decided we would do some traveling, find out through the traveling, through the experience that we might get, what kind of activities would be able to support us outside of architecture. Because personally, I thought that I couldn't make it as an architect, as a professional.
Well, or alternatively, that you would sacrifice your integrity if you did.
Well, that's what I meant. I couldn't fit myself in the profession as I knew of then. So I was trying to find a source of income that would allow me to have some free time to develop whatever it was at that point that I had vaguely in mind.
So you did identify activities to support yourselves?
Well, those activities were in the field of crafts. Also because I was interested in using my hands somehow.
And that was successful?
I guess so.
I mean,
it's very helpful now.
You kept yourself alive.
Mm-hmm.
But then why did you leave the North?
Well, it just happened that we... One thing was I wanted to know a little more about Italy. I knew very little about it, and Colin knew nothing. Then there was the fact of the climate, the appeal of the sea, and so on.
So, but still, you rejected Torino.
Yeah.
You didn't feel it was a compatible place for your ideas.
Well, you, especially when you're young, you always feel that maybe the next place is really what you are going to find something. So
you moved
on. It's part of the migratory impulse that you have when you're young.
And then you spent 3 years on the Amalfi Coast.
Mm-hmm. And we learned something about ceramics, and we built a little factory.
And then what was it that made you move on from there?
We had a flood that paralyzed this little town for over a year. It was very damaging. And a little power went off, water was off for quite a while, and Collie was in this country at that time for a wedding of her sister. So after struggling for about 8 months there, I decided that I would come back here.
And then when you returned to this country, you didn't come first to Arizona. You spent a little time in New Mexico.
Yeah, we spent a summer in Santa Fe.
And why didn't you settle there?
Well, very often in the morning, my pots were frozen. But that was August, so I said, if August gives me that, think of what December is going to bring.
So the idea of working outdoors that brought you back to the Phoenix area. And here you stay. You returned to Phoenix, which is where you'd been introduced to the desert. Why did you leave Taliesin after a relatively short time?
You nasty. Next question.
Well, that's always a question that's raised.
It's a question which is rejected.
Okay. When you came back to Phoenix, then you came to Doubletree Road, and you shared the house that you're in now, and gradually bought that property.
Yeah, well, we bought the property with some help, I think, from Chloe's father.
I wondered, in your choice of the property at Doubletree Road, whether that was quite accidental or whether there were some deliberate reasons why you were there. For instance, when one looks at Taliesin, one can understand that Mr. Wright was very deliberate in choosing that particular place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering why or how you chose the place that you are.
Well, when Mr. Wright chose Taliesin, he was a famous man. He was an established architect, a great artist, and he was in his 60s or something.
Yes.
Well, when we chose Doubletree, we were a couple with one child, and we couldn't afford very much. We needed to be near the city because of cost problems. So the conditions were totally different.
You're suggesting you didn't have much of a free choice.
Well, our ambitions were very limited, because we didn't have very much of a choice. And at that point, we were not in, again, in the idea of having a larger group. We were just trying to put roots and begin from there, and not knowing where we would go.
And alternatively, you didn't know that you'd be there for a long time.
No, I only knew that we would not be there forever, but that was it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that thought that you wouldn't be there forever, I suppose, was one of the generating ideas in the 60s when you began to think about the Kozanty Foundation on another location.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you remember, we started looking around many years ago.
Yes, it was in the early 60s.
Yeah.
One of the questions that's sometimes raised is has to do with the sort of social organization or the relationship between people in such a larger community. In the first proposals for a new Kozanty, it was very much the idea of an artist.